reluctant resignation in Puerto Rico, take two for temporary protected status for Venezuelans, and starting over in the search for a boss at a big college. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. After days of massive protests, Puerto Rico Governor Ricardo Rosselló announced his resignation this week. He will step down. But who will lead the territory in a week? Corruption allegations and offensive chat messages sent thousands of Puerto Ricans into the streets. They also demonstrated against La Junta, an unelected group overseeing the government's finances. The effort to give temporary protections to Venezuelans fleeing to America moved forward on Capitol Hill. The U.S. House voted for TPS for Venezuelans. It would affect thousands in South Florida. Plus, the fight to find a new leader at Miami-Dade College will start all over again. It's all ahead with your phone calls and texts on the South Florida Roundup. Program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson. The sound of Puerto Ricans celebrating a historic moment this week. Governor Ricardo Rosselló announced he will resign next Friday, the first governor in the island's history to do that. The feeling has rippled through the Puerto Rican community here in South Florida. Carlos Pilar from Kendall protested outside Miami's Freedom Tower this week for the governor's resignation just a few days ago.
I think there's a conscience already that we need to do better. We need to organize ourselves and say no to corruption in the first place and be transparent.
Angie Flores is a Puerto Rican-born resident of Miramar. She helped organize events here in South Florida for the community over the past 5 years.
Yo creo que si querían que el gobernador Rosselló saliera del poder,
she says that she would have preferred for the governor to go through an impeachment rather than the protests that forced his resignation. Those protests certainly gathered tens of thousands of Puerto Ricans in the streets of San Juan and elsewhere, and several protests here in South Florida. So this is where we begin the South Florida Roundup this week. Your thoughts on the resignation of Puerto Rico's governor? What will this mean for the island's future? What about the community in South Florida? Join the conversation on the telephone at 800-743-WLRN. The phone number, 800-743-9576. You could also send us a text to 786-786-7636. Again, the text line, if that's easier for you, it's fine. It's open as well. 786-786-7636. Just please include your first name and where you're texting from. Let's begin our conversation with Francis Robles with the New York Times, who's with us via Skype in San Juan. Frenchie, welcome back to WLRN. Tell us here, 1 week before the resignation takes effect here on this Friday, what's San Juan like?
Well, everybody's kind of on pins and needles because they really still don't know who's going to be governor. I mean, there's a sense that maybe the war isn't over, that it was just a battle, because there's a lot of machinations going on behind the scenes to pick who's going to be the governor of Puerto Rico. And is that person going to be suitable to the legislature? And more importantly, is it going to be suitable to the people on the streets?
So talk to us about that back and forth. Justice Secretary Wanda Vasquez, I think constitutionally correct, is the next in line.
She is next in line because the person who's second in line, that position, the Secretary of State, that position is vacant. So she's next in line today. You know, so if Rosselló had he made his resignation effective 5 p.m. today, then Wanda Vasquez, the Attorney General of Puerto Rico, would become governor. But because his resignation is not going to be effective until 5 p.m. next Friday, that gives the governor a week to fill the slot of Secretary of State, get that person confirmed through the legislature, and then constitutionally that person would become governor.
Is the legislature
do that by Friday?
Yeah, I was just going to say, is the legislative process set up to be that expedient, given all of the tension and controversy?
Well, for sure, they would hold an emergency session. That's not the question. The question is, can they come up with somebody that everybody could agree on? Mm-hmm. What everyone is hearing is that it's actually kind of shocking is that the head of the Senate wants to be the candidate, you know, wants to be the Secretary of State so that he could then run for governor in 2020. Mm-hmm. And so that is just not going to fly with the protesters. They are going to lose it. That's almost like worse than having the governor stay in his position, because it would be like a smack in the face of like old time party politics.
Yeah, which so much of which was under scrutiny here. And it, kind of the straw was, of course, the release of these hundreds of really controversial and offensive text messages. But that wasn't necessarily, well, it certainly wasn't the only thing here. It was the party politics that had been involved and kind of the system that has seen the public protests groundswell over the past dozen days.
That's absolutely right. You know, it'd be interesting when you interview people at the protests. Each person would have a different reason why they were there. They would say, well, they closed my kid's school. Or, oh, my son died a month ago and he's still at the morgue because it's, you know, they don't have a medical examiner to conduct the autopsy. Another person would say, well, my father died in the hurricane and they didn't count his deaths. You know, so it was a culmination of insult after insult after insult, on top of, you know, huge institutional problems like, you know, massive bankruptcy, yeah, and job cuts and things like that, that the people just decided that they were not having it anymore.
And we're going to talk a little bit more about that in just one moment. But give us a sense of daily life in San Juan here, so many months after Hurricane Maria, so many years into this debt crisis in Puerto Rico. Outside of the demonstrations, what are Puerto Ricans in San Juan and the island, what's life like for them economically and otherwise?
Well, a lot of people left. You know, a lot mm-hmm. of people went to Florida. So the people here who remain, you know, I don't know if abandoned is the right word. You know, a lot of them lost their jobs. A lot of businesses closed. But on the other hand, there's a post-hurricane economic revival, you know, so there's jobs because of that. Mm-hmm. I think they don't want to be the ones left behind. They don't want to be in a place where, you know, 50% live in poverty and the rest of them have, you know, schools that are closing. And, you know, they're getting by. They do their thing. They, you know, they're going to restaurants and they go dancing on the weekend. But they want something better. They want Puerto Rico to improve.
We're talking with Francis Robles with the New York Times, with us from San Juan, Puerto Rico. You're listening to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN, talking about Puerto Rico and the governor, Ricardo Rossello, announcing he will resign a week from Friday, next Friday. Your thoughts, impressions of Puerto Rico. How's this affecting your community, your family, your coworkers, your colleagues? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576, or the text line at 786-786-7636. Again, the text line 786-786-7636. Noel Zamat joins us now. He worked on the island's Congressional Oversight Board until March of this year. He joins us from our sister station in Tampa, WUSF. That board was a congressionally mandated oversight board put in place in 2016. Noel Zamat, welcome to WLRN. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure being here.
You were the revitalization coordinator with the Federal Oversight and Management Board. Give us a quick tutorial on the role of that board within the Puerto Rican economy.
Yeah, it's a pretty interesting time in U.S. history, and definitely for Puerto Rico. The long story made short is that over decades, Puerto Rico got into a significant debt issue. And in the last administration under Governor Alejandro Garcia Padilla, they essentially said that the debt was unpayable. In the attempt to declare bankruptcy, Congress enacted a law called PROMESA. And that law instituted an oversight board for the island. The objective of that board is to return Puerto Rico to the capital markets via debt restructuring and some structural changes carried out by the development and implementation of fiscal plans. My role was the sole identified economic development position in the statute. And in short, what I did was try to catalyze private investment in the island through a number of tools that we had to expedite the process of permitting for projects that mm-hmm. really dealt with a critical infrastructure emergency on the island.
We saw this board as one target of protesters over the past dozen days as they swelled into the streets of San Juan. Were you surprised by that, that this board has taken such a public outward-facing criticism now?
I'm not surprised. I will say in general that it's not necessarily warranted. The board is not there to punish the people of Puerto Rico. It's there because of a congressional view that it was necessary for the government of Puerto Rico to be held to account on what we are now seeing was decades of mm-hmm. economic mismanagement through this corruption scandal.
Francis Robles, not to punish Puerto Rico, but do Puerto Ricans on the island see it the same way for this Federal Oversight and Management Board?
Oh, well, I think Mr. Antoine knows how people feel about the oversight board. I mean, people feel that the board is here to squeeze every last drop out of Puerto Rico to pay off Wall Street. I mean, that's, you know, I don't know that there's ever going to be much way to convince people otherwise. They deeply, deeply resent the measures that the board had recommended. Not all of them went through, but, mm-hmm. you know, things like, a Christmas bonus sounds frivolous, but the salaries are pretty low. Cutting back on hourly, shifts and all kinds of cuts and schools. Hundreds of schools have closed, although that's also because the population declined. And so the feeling is that these people on the board, and you tell me, I hear the figure $625,000 is the salary of the CEO. I could be wrong on those numbers. But, you know, meanwhile, the head of that board or the staff executive yeah. director of that board makes a lot of money.
Noel, how about it? Do you know what the executive director makes at the board?
I don't have the numbers right in front of me. I think the number sounds reasonable. You know, I think it is to be expected that this is a touchy issue. This is the first time really in any U.S. jurisdiction that a measure like this has been taken on. And, you know, it's understandable that the people of Puerto Rico feel a certain level of frustration at the fact that a lot of the decisions that they were able to do previously are now essentially being taken by this unelected board. I think there's a deeper, perhaps not a public policy issue, but a structural issue here, which is the government of Puerto Rico over decades had this challenge with mismanagement, and Congress decided this board was created by Congress. It is a creature of Congress. And Congress decided at the time that was the best way to deal with the challenge. I'm under no, and many are, under no illusions that it's not a very politically sensitive situation, but it's really the view of Congress that this needed to happen.
Is it working at all? I mean, is it really doing the kinds of things that it's designed to do for the Puerto Rican population, not for Wall Street and the bond issuers? And, you know, the investors, but is it doing what it is designed to do for Puerto Ricans?
I think the events of the past 2 weeks have given you an insight into why it has been so difficult to really reach the outcomes that Congress had envisioned for the board. What you saw in the chat and Telegram gate in many cases was just this dismissiveness against the process, outright hostility against the process of the board. In many cases, the members of that chat working to really kneecap a lot of the initiatives that the board had, in many cases, a more strategic view would have said that a more collaborative process between the government of Puerto Rico and the board probably would have yielded better results for the people of Puerto Rico and addressed a lot of the issues that I think have rightly been brought up. But instead, this became a, the perception on the island is that there was this small group of young men that were treating this as their economic playground, and they treated the board likewise.
The austerity measures that the board has put into place, which is an oftentimes euphemism for spending cuts on the part of government agencies, as Frenchie has said, you know, those are real bread and butter household economic issues for Puerto Ricans who have remained on the island. How does any new administration in the part of the governor's office in Puerto Rico change any of that, or does it?
Well, I've testified in Congress twice on this matter, and there's there's a lot of interesting nuance in this issue. I'll take education as one case. Puerto Rico's education budget, including both local and federal funds, spends on average $1,800 more per student than the average in the U.S. states. And that's a fact. You can look that up. What's interesting is that the outcomes for Puerto Rico are 53rd behind all 50 states, DOD schools, and the District of Columbia. And yet they spend a lot more. This is not this administration's fault. This is an historical issue. And it really just goes to the point that over decades, the administrations of Puerto Rico and the government of Puerto Rico really got into this lax mindset of not doing the best they could with either federal or local funds. And that pushes us to really a bunch of unpopular measures, mm-hmm. really at the end of the tail.
It sounds like, Frenchie, what you're hearing from this former member of the Federal Oversight and Management Board in terms of working with that as the revitalization coordinator. The decisions that this board is still going to be faced with aren't going to change even if there's a new administration in place on the island.
You broke up a bit there, so I don't know that I heard the entire question. But, yeah, the structural problems are still there. That's, you know, the people are jubilant that they'll have a new governor. But, you know, the board is still there. The cutbacks are still there. The 3,000 people who died in the hurricane are still there. You know, so the Jones Act that drives up the prices of goods in Puerto Rico is still there. You know, so the new person is not going to be able to change a lot of the things that people want changed. But what they want is a person who is going to look at things through a different lens, a lens of the people, and not, you know, what the things that Noel was referring to, you know, looking at the government as their own personal piggy bank and way to enrich themselves and their political standing.
Noel, you've talked about radical transparency when it comes to the Federal Oversight and Management Board. You worked as the revitalization coordinator looking for economic development opportunities. You were working alongside infrastructure investment to the tune of billions of dollars when it comes to the electrical grid, for instance, which was so vulnerable, and we saw the catastrophic consequences after Hurricane Maria. Give us a real on-the-ground, sober view of the board's decisions ahead of it and how that is going to affect Puerto Ricans who remain on the island.
Well, one of the challenges that we currently have is that the board really has their hands completely full. And I know the people, I still know the people there very well. You know, we get along well. I get along well with people in the government of Puerto Rico, by the way, who were equally frustrated with what they saw as far as corruption and Telegram Gate. So I don't want to paint an us versus them picture here. It turns out that there's a significant number of folks in Puerto Rico that have a very similar view as to what went wrong and how it could be fixed. The board has a significant challenge right now in renegotiating the debt in the context and crafting these fiscal plans in the context of what has just happened. Particularly since the tone in the federal government has really taken an unexpected but very serious turn with respect to expectations for federal disbursement in the aftermath of this crisis.
Francis Robles with the New York Times. Tell us what this next week looks like with all the political maneuvering that's likely to happen.
So things are kind of quiet right now. There was a rally yesterday, but, you know, people are sort of retrenching back to their homes. But I do think that everyone is very tense, very, very much ready and thinking, okay, maybe I don't pack up my flag that I used for my protest just yet. They're quite ready to hit the streets again if there seems to be political gamesmanship going on instead of, you know, just constitutional transition.
And Noel Zamot, how sensitive is the Federal Oversight and Management Board, this fiscal group in Puerto Rico that's unelected? How sensitive is it, do you think, to the kinds of protests that we've seen, as well as this this question about leadership of Puerto Rico that needs to be answered in the next week?
I think in broad terms, the board is – this is going to sound strange to a lot of people, but they're very respectful of the fact that they know what their swim lane is as far as this type of public policy. I think what I can tell you is that pretty much everybody there respects the right of the American citizens in Puerto Rico to demonstrate as they did. And this was, I think, a a world-renowned exercise in democracy that we have just seen in the island where I was born. And for mm-hmm. those of us from Puerto Rico, in a way, it makes us immensely proud to see that with no loss of life, maybe a couple of people got injured, but it's amazing that this has happened in Puerto Rico under this context. I think the board understands that now is the time to let the political process play out, see how the constitutional process in Puerto Rico under the laws of the federal laws on which it is based really allow Puerto Rico to transition from Governor Rosselló to whoever the next acting governor will be.
Noel Zamat, thank you for sharing your experiences with us, former revitalization coordinator with the Federal Oversight Management Board in Puerto Rico. He's joining us from Tampa, where he lives and works now with Atabay Group. Noel, thank you for your time. And Frenchie, always great to hear from you, New York Times correspondent with us via Skype from San Juan, Puerto Rico. To both of you, thanks for joining us here on the South Florida Roundup.
Thank you.
Thanks for your interest, Tom.
More to come here today. The U.S. House passing a bill granting TPS for Venezuelans. We talk with two South Florida representatives pushing for the bill, one Democrat, one Republican. That's next on the Roundup. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. The United States is a step closer to granting temporary protected status, TPS, for Venezuelans. On Thursday, the U.S. House of Representatives passed a bill sponsored by two Florida lawmakers, Miami's Mario Diaz-Balart and Darren Soto of Kissimmee. Other members of the South Florida congressional delegation from both parties have pushed for the bill's passage over the past several days, if not several months. The bill now heads to the U.S. Senate for consideration. If passed there, it would, of course, go on to President Trump. Now, earlier today, WLRN's America's editor Tim Padgett and I spoke with Miami-Dade Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Mercosal-Powell about the bill. Congresswoman, welcome back to WLRN. Tell us, why do you think temporary protected status is needed by Venezuelans?
So temporary protected status was created specifically for situations like the one that we're seeing in Venezuela, for people that are fleeing very dire circumstances. Right now, we have seen the worst humanitarian crisis in this hemisphere. Maduro continues to really kill his own people in the country. We have seen about 79% of healthcare providers in Venezuela have fled the country. The power outages continue. So even if Nicolas Maduro were to leave Venezuela tomorrow, we would not be able to send more than 200,000 Venezuelans back to a country that will need years to be able to be built to where it was before.
Congresswoman, I think a lot of people were surprised to see the measure pass in the House yesterday after it was defeated in a special vote on Tuesday that required a supermajority, and then they saw it come to a regular vote that only needed a simple majority. How were you able to accelerate the process to get a vote in before Congress goes on recess this weekend?
We wanted to expedite the process by bringing it under a suspension vote on Tuesday, which was very interesting to see that only 37 Republicans voted with us on Tuesday. We did need the two-third majority after that vote. What also the Democratic caucus and leadership saw is that every single Democrat did support this measure. So we were able to, with the help, of course, of my colleague and friend, Donna Shalala, who's in the Rules Committee, I was able to pass the TPS for Venezuela through the Judiciary Committee in a very fast manner. And then having Donna on the Rules Committee was very helpful as well. So we were able to bring it to a vote yesterday. And again, we saw that over 180 Republicans voted against it. For all the talk that we hear from this president and this administration that they want to support the Venezuelan people, again, yesterday we saw that many Republicans are not where they need to be in this issue.
But how important a role did Republican Congressman Mario Diaz-Balart, who was one of the co-sponsors of the bill, play in finally getting that vote, that successful vote, to take place yesterday?
On Tuesday, when we saw that the suspension vote was not going to pass, we did speak with Mario to help us get other Republicans on board. So I'm not sure if he was able to do that on his side, but on our side, because we have the majority, we moved fairly quickly, and we did have the support of all of our colleagues, including leadership.
So there was a change in process in order for this vote to happen and for it to find the simple majority on Thursday. Were there any changes in the policy that was proposed in this legislation in order for that vote to happen?
The bill remained the same. And it was a very simple bill. I mean, it was very straightforward.
It's only five or six pages long. Who does it apply to if it's successful?
It applies to Venezuelans that have been here continuously, for the Venezuelans that are already living here in the United States. And it will allow for them to remain here for 18 months temporarily.
Is there a start date for those Venezuelans? Is there a start date for those Venezuelans who have...
It will start the day that the bill is enacted and signed.
But for those Venezuelans that are here already, at what point do those Venezuelans become eligible for TPS under this legislation for those that may not be eligible for it?
For the ones that are here in the United States, they will all become eligible.
Regardless of when they arrived?
Yes. So, yes. But they have to go through the vetting process. So you do have to go through a process. You have to apply. You have to pay a fee to be able to apply to be eligible for TPS. But it does have to be signed into law before they can start applying. And that's why I think it's important that we bring this, that the Senate takes this bill up as soon as possible.
And what are the chances then that the Senate will pass this, in your estimation?
Well, I do know that Senator Menendez and Senator Rubio have a bill, and they have been putting pressure on their colleagues. And really, this is the time for Republicans to show whether all their words are going to be transferred into action. And it'll be an interesting moment next week. They have session next week. We'll see if they expedite it the way that we did. But we think, in any case, that if the executive wasn't going to take action, we in the House were going to do that.
And if it goes to President Trump's desk, do you think he'll sign it? Because every indication seems to be from the White House and his administration that they really aren't in favor of granting TPS to Venezuelans.
You know, unfortunately, this president has been taking a stance against any sort of immigration reform, any sort of bills. I mean, we passed the Dreamer TPS bill for those that already have TPS to extend that TPS status to Haitians, people from El Salvador. And the Senate hasn't brought that one for a vote. And what I can tell you is that I don't know what the president is going to do. We will have to see. But we can't stop sending these bills to show the American people what our priorities are. And since January, we've been fighting to not only help the Venezuelans restore their democracy in Venezuela by sending humanitarian aid, by ensuring that we are not selling arms to Venezuela during this time when we have a narco regime under Nicolas Maduro, but also take a step to protect those Venezuelans that are living right here in the United States.
One of the criticisms that the administration has had about the use of TPS by prior administrations is that once TPS is granted at an 18-month time frame, it tends to be repeated and renewed for many, many years in some cases. And so how temporary is the TPS program these days?
In the law, it says that it's provided for 18 months and you are eligible for applying for a renewal. Now, the problem, when you look at Haiti and our Haitian neighbors that are here and living, so many of them, thousands of them in South Florida, they can't go back to Haiti. So they've had to reapply for the protected status. Many of them fleeing not only very dangerous regimes and violence, but also famine. After what happened with the earthquake in Haiti, we saw that it was, massive destruction in that country. So they were not able to return. And I can assure you that people that come to this country seeking refuge don't necessarily choose to leave their home country. They have been forced to do that. And we have a way of providing status for them. It's part of an overall immigration policy that we need to be having conversations about. But the last thing we want to do is deport Venezuelans to a country that is completely destroyed by Nicolas Maduro.
But to Tom's point, many Republicans in the House this week during debate on this bill were making what some feel is a very valid point, that TPS has simply become PPS, permanent protected status. Does the whole idea, program of TPS need to be rethought and revised in that regard?
I had this conversation with the ranking member in the Judiciary Committee, with Representative Collins, just on Tuesday when we were trying to get this through this suspension vote. And what him and I agreed to do is to have the conversation of putting other bills on through Judiciary Committee that will deal with these problems that we have in our immigration system. It is true. It should be a temporary protected status. What's happened is that some of these countries have never reached a level where people can actually go back to their countries, and then they've remained here. They've had kids in the United States. So that has been one of the areas where we've been working on, so that they not only, for people that have been here for a long period of time, not only become have the TPS status, but they can also apply for them to remain here legally. I mean, this country has had a process for decades where people can apply for legal residency. Now, the problem is that we've had an administration that has been completely against any sort of immigration reform, or even allowing people to seek refuge and asylum. And so these are conversations that are complicated, but that we have to have. And I am willing to work with my Republican colleagues. This should be a bipartisan conversation, but we can't start a conversation when you have an administration that has been criminalizing all immigrants that want to end asylum and refugee requests. We have to start in a better place.
Congresswoman, thank you so much for your time. We'll let you get your summer vacation, summer recess underway. Congresswoman Debbie Mukherjee Powell is along with us from her office on Capitol Hill.
Thank you very much.
We're joined now by Miami Republican Congressman Mario Diaz-Balart, one of the co-sponsors of the temporary protection status building. A bill, rather, that did pass out of the U.S. House on Thursday. Congressman, thanks so much for joining us here on WLRN. Have you received any assurances from President Trump that he will sign this legislation if it's approved by the Senate?
Well, here's what I've been in contact with the administration for quite some time. And, you know, we have to recall what's happening here. This administration has been, frankly, exceedingly positive on helping the Venezuelan people in the cause for freedom. That's a big contrast from what we had for the last 8 years. This administration understands as well that what's happening on the ground in Venezuela. You'll notice that, for example, the administration did not do a statement of administrative policy, in other words, a veto threat on this legislation. They do it, you know, it's kind of a routine thing that they'll do out these letters if they have objections or or issues with it. That was not done. And that was not done because I've been in contact and others have been in contact with the administration. There's a lot of noise out there about, you know, criticizing one or the other. Let me tell you what the truth is. The truth is that, for example, for 8 years, the previous administration could have done immigration reform. I was part of a bipartisan group.
Yeah.
By the way, when the Democrats had 60 votes in the Senate, they didn't need a Republican. They had
Congressman,
majorities in the House.
Let me finish, as it relates to Venezuelans and whether or not the president has assured you or the administration has given you any kind of indication about how President Trump may greet this legislation if it meets
his
desk.
I just mentioned what I just said, but I think it's important to not just listen to noise and have some perspective,
right?
Because and get some of the facts. So, previous administration, when they had opportunities, ample opportunities to help, they did not. They killed the effort. Speaker of the House Pelosi, in multiple occasions, the last time just months ago, when she could have, by the way, for example, inserted the legalization with citizenship of all the Dreamers, refused so. And the reason I say that is because I respect my colleague who just spoke. But it's important to not just kind of make things up and throw a lot of noise and look for solutions. That's why what I did, working with Darren Soto, he and I filed a bill that we just got through the House, which I think is a major, major step. I've been, you know, it's always more difficult to get anything done in the Senate, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping that the Senate can move on the bill. The differences between the House bill and the Senate bill can be resolved in 15 minutes. I'm hoping that happens, and then that we can work with the administration on whatever they may have objections to. As of now, they've not expressed any, which is, I think, a very important step.
Okay. Congressman, as the co-sponsor of this bill, do you feel, as most Venezuelans here feel, that for President Trump not to sign this legislation would be a gross inconsistency between the rhetoric in which we're saying that the regime in Venezuela is dangerous enough to both Venezuelans and to our own national security to pursue overthrowing it, but yet we'd be saying at the same time the Venezuelans who are escaping that regime are not worth protecting?
Yeah, look, I'm glad you brought that up. But the only disagreement I would have on your statement is that it's not only rhetoric about what it's doing vis-a-vis the Venezuelan dictatorship. It's actually action, as you well know.
So okay, sure. I'll grant you that, yes.
Right. Now, absolutely, to me, and I've stated this publicly, I said it on the floor of the House, I've said it to whoever will listen, including to the administration, it would be totally unacceptable to, while this reality, this dictatorship, is not only destroying the Venezuelan, the country, but it's also repressing its people, to send Venezuelans back to that country. That would be absolutely unacceptable. So I don't know if I can say it in any stronger terms. To me, it is unacceptable, which is why working with Congressman Darren Soto, by the way, who's a Democrat from Central Florida, who has been heroic in this effort, how he has worked it just in every possible way. That's why we filed this bill, because precisely I think it would be beyond unacceptable to send Venezuelans back to Venezuela under the current circumstances.
But listening to the debate on the Republican side of the aisle this week about this legislation, one got the sense that they were making it clear that the Republican voter base in this country will not be happy if they see President Trump extend TPS to yet another national group. Do you worry, again, as the co-sponsor of this bill, that President Trump may come down on the side of that base in an election year like this?
Well, look, obviously, a couple things. As you know, the whole TPS system right now is in the courts.
Right.
I don't have to, go into that. You're aware of why, the fact that it was meant to be temporary. It's not temporary. The administration wants Congress to act on reforming it. Congress has not been able or willing to do it. Which is why we have done, frankly, something that does not have a lot of precedent, which is trying to do, in essence, TPS legislatively. Do I have assurances that the president would sign a legislative bill that, in essence, does TPS? I don't have assurances, but I'm in communication. Not only am I in communication on this bill, I'm also in communications to figure out what other alternatives exist if, for some reason, and it's not unlikely that the Senate runs out of time, because I don't want to be overly negative, but the Senate doesn't act that quickly. So I am absolutely, absolutely committed to doing this. I am working with the administration, which is why it's important to, while understanding history, lower the rhetoric, work together, like Congressman Soto, Democrat, has worked with me, and also Senator Bob Menendez is working with mm-hmm. Senator Marco Rubio in a bipartisan way in the Senate to try to get something done, which I think is, frankly, a no-brainer, and it would be absolutely unacceptable to send these folks back.
Congressman Diaz-Balart, you mentioned this legislative answer to temporary protected status for Venezuelans, if unsuccessful in moving through the Senate or unsuccessful with President Trump, what other alternatives do exist?
Look, that's what we're exploring. Are there other alternatives that again, as you say, if the Senate can't get it done, or better case scenario would be that the Senate gets it done, that we finalize the negotiations, which I think would be relatively quick. Get it to the president's desk, and then because of whatever reason, including potentially the fact that this is all the TPS stuff is still in the courts, and therefore they don't want to do it, are there other alternatives? There are. I don't want to get into a lot of detail because I've had multiple conversations, not only some conversations with the administration, but others with colleagues of mine.
So are they administrative alternatives then, that would executive alternatives that would come from the executive branch?
There may potentially be some. There may potentially be some. Now, I will tell you, and I am not shy about saying this, to me, I'm a legislator, so I always prefer a legislative fix, which is why we're moving in this direction, because I think that would be the cleanest way, mm-hmm. Not the simplest, but the cleanest way. So that's my preference. But again, you have to, prepare for the worst, right? And that's what we're doing, and I'm working every angle because, again, I mentioned before, what is unacceptable to me, it would be, frankly, very detrimental, would be to send Venezuelans who have been able to get to the United States fleeing what is a murderous socialist regime, sending back those Venezuelans to this murderous socialist regime is totally unacceptable. I do want to say one of the things that did take me back. You mentioned about what was said on the floor. The other thing that took – so I didn't like parts of the debate, obviously. But the other part that took me back was the fact that surprised me that there was language, non-controversial language, that was presented, a language that just stated the fact that what is happening in Venezuela is caused by the socialist Maduro Chavez dictatorship, and that almost on a party line vote was rejected.
Yes.
Now that was also surprising. And by the way, I know that there are my colleagues, Democratic colleagues, who agree with that language, but that just tells you how politicized things are, which is why it's important to try to lower the rhetoric, lower the volume, and let's just try to get this done.
Congressman, we'll leave it there. Congressman Mario Diaz-Balart, Republican from District 25 here in central Dade County. Congressman, nice to have you back on WLRN. Thanks for your thoughts today.
Great pleasure. Thank you very much.
Always appreciate it. Tim, thank you for your thoughts as well. Thanks for the coverage.
Thank you.
Still to come on our program here right now on the South Florida Roundup, the search for Miami-Dade College's new president. It starts again. It's all up next. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Lots to discuss still here before the hour gets away from us. Miami-Dade College is hitting reset on its search for a new leader. Several finalists gave presentations this week. The school's Board of Trustees, though, decided to start all over and seek out more qualified people. Joining us now is the Miami Herald's Samantha Gross. She covered the expected vote this week. Also in studio with us is Javier Soto, CEO of the Miami Foundation and a member of Miami-Dade College's presidential search committee that put forth the recommendations from the four candidates that the trustees heard from this week. And Colleen Wright, who covers education for our partner, the Miami Herald, also along with us. Maybe you're an alum of Miami-Dade College or a current student or a faculty member or an adjunct member. What do you think about this public display of looking for a replacement of Eduardo Padron as the leader of Miami-Dade College? You can give us a call here on the South Florida Roundup. Our phone number is 800. Let me find the phone number here because I don't have that memorized after so many years. You'd think that I would, but I don't. 800-743-WLRN is the phone number, 800-743-9576. That's the curse of cell phones these days. You don't have the phone numbers in there anymore. Samantha Gross, let me begin with you. What happened this week? Walk us through the process and where we are now at the beginning again.
Yeah, so this week was 3 days of presentations and interviews and deliberation looking at the four finalists to replace Dr. Padron as Miami-Dade College's president. So the candidates were Reagan Romali, Davina Grossman, Paul Brody, and the only internal candidate was Vice President and Provost Lenore Verdicio. And what had happened on Monday and Tuesday is they gave presentations to the community and took questions, and on Wednesday, the Board of Trustees was interviewing all four candidates, and then they were supposed to come down to a vote. And what had happened was they decided that they wanted more candidates. They didn't think that the pool was the right pool that they were hoping to choose from, and they decided to postpone the vote and start from scratch. So they kept Dr. Rodizio as one of the finalists, and the other three were kind of automatically
dismissed, essentially, right? Yeah. Javier Soto was one of those. You constructed the pool for folks at the Board of Trustees of Miami-Dade College to consider those applicants. What do you feel about the process that you saw play out this week?
I think what happened this week is a travesty. I think it's absolutely outrageous. The process before this point had been incredibly professionally run. It was a transparent process. highly ethical and thorough process. And the four candidates that were submitted to the board by the search committee, 17 members voting unanimously on the committee, were supremely qualified to be the next leader of Miami-Dade College.
And since the Board of Trustees is going to go back from the beginning, is the search committee still in operation?
No, we were disbanded once our job was done. Once we communicated the four finalists to the board, we were dismissed as the search committee.
And so your work is finished. The search committee is no longer responsible for coming up with this new pool of candidates that the Board of Trustees would like to see from.
I have no idea what the board is going to do now, but they received four incredibly qualified candidates after a nationwide search where over 500 potential candidates were contacted by Diversified Search. And they got four qualified individuals, all of whom could have done a phenomenal job at Miami-Dade College. I don't know where they go from here.
So how do you explain how they got here?
How do I explain their decision?
The decision about how they got here.
I have no idea. I know the best practice is to set a process, follow that process to its conclusion, and not blow it up on the finish line.
Colleen Wright, you've covered education with our partner, the Miami Herald. You've seen this process play out here, certainly. What's at stake and what's afoot?
You know, I would call it that it's been a rocky process, I would say, the whole time. I know that when they were selecting candidates, they set a deadline, but then there was kind of like some wiggle room for two dark horse candidates. That didn't happen. Nobody came in kind of at the 11th hour. Then I know that there was a vote to strip the academic requirements. There was a requirement to strip the doctoral degree requirement, instead putting in a terminal degree, and that could be like a Juris Doctorate, which is not like a college search. And then they also wanted to scrap, I believe, a requirement for 10 years of experience at an institution of higher education.
Those changes in the qualifications, correct me if I'm wrong, Colleen, corresponded with changes in those that would make the ultimate decision on hiring Dr. Padron's replacement, correct?
Yeah, that was
in terms of the change of personnel on the Board of Trustees for the college.
Right, that was a change that the Board of Trustees deliberated over, and it eventually actually failed 4-3, which is interesting because one of the trustees who was in the four to keep those requirements has recently been replaced pretty much at the end of this process. I believe Nicole Washington came on, I believe, around last week or so, two weeks ago. The process just, it's been a rocky process.
So, yeah. Samantha, what is next here? Javier Soto's, selection committee has been disbanded. He doesn't know what's going on. The Board of Trustees has started from the reset. Is there any explicit public statement about what the process looks now?
Nothing official. They had not set a time certain for their next meeting, but they said they will be meeting in around 2 weeks to figure out what they're going to do with the 17-member search committee, if they're going to form a new one, if they're going to recruit more people. And then they also have to figure out what they're going to do with an interim president and if they're going to find one. Dr. Padron is at, you know, his term ends in 6 weeks, right before the school year starts, and they're going to have to make a lot of hard decisions.
Javier Soto, would you serve on another selection committee if asked?
Let me be very clear. Absolutely not. I will not help legitimize what has become a farce. So the answer is no.
And what has contributed to your estimation that this process has become, as you call it, a farce?
Because the process up to this point had been incredibly professionally run and needed to be played out to its conclusion.
So what happened in your estimation then? What got a hold of the process to derail it in your description?
I don't have any knowledge of what happened beyond the point where the search committee communicated, as we were directed to do, the four finalists for the job. Why the board took the decision that they did, I don't have knowledge of that. You'd have to ask members of that board. But all I know is that they have blown up the entire process at the finish line, and it contradicts sort of every best practice imaginable for a search of this magnitude.
Colleen, what do you think this does to the reputation of Miami-Dade College, which has been a preeminent community-based higher education system? I mean, Dr. Padron was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom.
That's right. He was awarded that award by President Obama.
Right.
I mean, this is the largest institution of higher education in the country, and it's a big deal. And Padron has been there for 50 years, I believe, president for almost 25, quarter century. We don't know what this does. And you're right. The process, it has been rocky. It was kind of anticlimactic, the way it kind of all fell apart in the end. I don't know what they're searching for. I know that when they were deliberating, striking those academia requirements that I described earlier, there were rumors and there was kind of this idea that maybe they were doing it in favor of a specific candidate, although other people think that, some believe that the process was rigged in favor of the internal candidate. So there's two camps of thought, but at the end of the day, we have, we don't know who is going to replace Pittman.
And all,
at this point.
I can say from the search committee standpoint is this was absolutely not rigged for anybody. It was a transparent process, an ethical process, totally above board. And I also would question, by the way, Tom, who in their right mind now who is working as a leader in higher ed in the United States of America is going to put their name forward to participate in this process?
Sam? Colleen?
Yeah, and to add to that, I had heard that there were several qualified candidates out there who didn't, stick their neck out and put their name in the hat because of possibly the Sunshine Law that's been talked about, a lot.
Javier, were there candidates that the selection committee identified, but they pulled their own name out of the hat because of process or concerns?
We understand that to have happened according to Diversified Search, not with specific names, but just individuals that they may have reached out to who expressed a desire not to participate.
Yeah.
For a number of reasons, including perhaps the Sunshine issue.
Javier Soto, a member of the now disbanded selection committee for the Miami-Dade College presidential search and soon to be former CEO of the Miami Foundation. Javier, nice to have you back on.
Thank you, Tom.
Colleen Wright, good to have you. And Samantha Gross with our partner, the Miami Herald, both of you. Thank you for joining us on the Florida Roundup.
Thank you.
Our program is produced by Alexander Gonzalez. Engagement producer is Katie Lepre. Our director of radio operations is Peter J. Meritz. Radio programming and technical supervisor, Jason Zabka. And Richard Ives. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling. The program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist. Mm-hmm.